the kinds of values that the Permian fans harbored about themselves. What made those boys great on the football field had made the fans great as well. Just as the boys had produced against all odds, so they had produced in the oil field against all odds, not with brains and fancy talk, but with brawn and muscle and endurance and self-sacrifice. Such symbolism wasn't lost on Lawrence Hurd as he continued to fight for school desegregation. It wasn't necessary to live in Odessa for long to realize that the Permian football team wasn't just a high school team, but a sacrosanct white institution. Mojo seemed to have a mystical charm to it, said Hurd. The school itself was 94% white in 1980, with 14 blacks and 94 Mexican-Americans out of 2,031 students. And he truly believed there would be blood in the streets before Permian supporters would allow their school to be tampered with in any way that might be even remotely perceived as detrimental. Another key figure in the desegregation battle, Vicky Gomez, who in 1976 became the first minority candidate ever elected to the school board, had come to a similar conclusion. "The thing was to preserve Mojo's whiteness," said Gomez. "The school board and the administration were determined that whatever happened, Mojo was not going to suffer in any way." In the spring of 1982, U.S. District Judge Fred Shannon ruled that the failure of the school district to dismantle its formerly dual school system is very clear in this case. The historically black schools have never been desegregated, and since 1954 have remained either all black or virtually all black and Mexican American. In no less than six different areas, Shannon concluded on the basis of testimony, the school system not only continued to fail to meet its duty to dismantle its dual school system, but actually increased the segregation in its schools of both blacks and Mexican Americans. It was a moment of euphoria for the minority community, until Shannon strongly hinted at a solution. Opposed to increased busing, Shannon concluded that the quickest, surest way to achieve desegregation was to close Ector High School, since it had a relatively small population. As a result, its students were dispersed across the railroad tracks to the remaining two high schools in town, Permian and Odessa High. As a school, most whites never had much use for Ector once it had become pegged as the minority school. It was on the south side, and the less heard about the area, the better. "I think the community perceived it as a minority place, a place they wouldn't travel into," said Jim Moore. "I think most of them perceived it as a place to keep them over there and let them have their school." But with Ector's closing, members of the white community suddenly began to see enormous value in some of its black students. It had nothing to do with academic potential. It had everything to do with athletic potential. Once the plan was announced, a hotly debated aspect of it wasn't curriculum or how minorities would fare in schools that had always been predominantly white. Instead, there was remarkable focus on which school, Permian or Odessa High, would ultimately get the greater number of black students and thereby the greater number of black football players. The answer depended on how the South Side was divvied up between the two schools in the aftermath of the court battle. The curious zigs and zags of the proposed division gave Permian a clear edge over Odessa High in the number of blacks assigned to go there, based on where they lived. Gomez said the line was drawn that way not for the cause of desegregation, nor to satisfy any academic purpose, nor even to meet any racial quota, but to ensure Permian a greater number of black running backs down the road than its rival. "It was gerrymandering over football," said Gomez, who had not been in the least surprised. In the endless deliberations over desegregation, the board spent more time worrying about how the high school athletic programs might be affected than how the curriculum might be affected. "Whatever they did, They did not want to hurt the dynasty that was being established at Permian, she said. I think it clouded their vision. We spend more time talking about the athletic program than the curriculum. Part 4. You could search high and low for a black city councilman in 1988, or a black county commissioner, or a black school board member in Odessa. You wouldn't find one. You could search high and low for a black at the Rotary Club breakfast over at the Holiday Inn, or at the luncheon meeting of the Optimist Club over at the junior college. You wouldn't find one there either, just like in every other community in America. But on Friday nights in Odessa, you could gaze down at the football field and see several black players tearing up the field for Permian. Thanks to desegregation, football was blacks' claim to fame in Odessa, the thing they were known for, and there was no better proof than the Wall of Fame. Just inside the entrance to the Permian Fieldhouse, the wall contained the framed pictures of 61 players, each of whom had been All-State. To have one's picture hanging there in a little frame with black trim was a cherished honor. The wall also offered a quick and easy lesson on the history of race relations in Odessa. From 1959, when Permian opened, until 1982, there was only one black face on that wall out of pictures of 45 players. The name of the player was Darrell Hunt. He happened to be from the first black family ever to live across the tracks in the northeast part of town. He also happened to be the best football player ever at Permian, becoming an All-American linebacker at Oklahoma University and then a member of the Houston Oilers for 6 years. Since the desegregation of the schools, the representation of black players on the Wall of Fame had dramatically increased. Of the 16 pictures added to the Wall of Fame since 1982, 5 were of blacks. Desegregation had not altered the essential character of the Permian program. It was still a white institution. The overwhelming majority of its fans were still white. The overwhelming majority of its players were still white. But those few blacks attending Permian had made enormous contributions, one after another shipped across town to Permian for the mass enjoyment of an appreciative white audience, and then shipped right back again across the railroad tracks to the South Side after each game. Booby Miles came from the South Side. So did his replacement, Chris Comer. So did Ivory Christian. So did Brian Johnson, who started at defensive end. We fit as athletes, but we really don't fit as a part of society, said Nate Herm, the only black coach at Permian in 1988. We know that we're separate until we get on the field. We know that we're equal as athletes. But once we get off the field, we're not equal. When it comes time to play the game, we are a part of it. But after the game, we are not a part of it. In the fall of 1988, there were 147 blacks, 6% of the student body, attending Permian. There were none among the 47 students taking Honors Physics 1. There were none among the 8 taking Honors Physics 2. There were none among the 52 students taking Honors Biology 2. There were 3 among the 65 taking Honors Chemistry 1. There were 4 among the 93 taking Honors Algebra 2. There was 1 among the 82 taking Honors Pre-Calculus. There were none among the 37 taking Honors Calculus. There were none among the 99 students taking Honors English 3. There were 2 among the 91 students taking Honors English 4. There were none on the student council. There were none who were cheerleaders. On the Permian team, 6 of the 55 players were black. In the basketball program, 15 of the 39 players were black. Blacks also made up relatively high percentages in remedial courses. Numbers aside, their domination of the football team was astounding. Of the 6 who were with the team at the beginning of practice in August, 5 were starters and the 6th was hurt. 2 of these players started both ways. the only ones on the entire team to do so. On offense, black athletes started at flanker, split end, and fullback. On defense, they started at middle linebacker, defensive end, safety, and rover. There was an apocryphal story that football coaches all over the state of Texas had cried when desegregation came to Odessa because it gave Permian the one thing it had never had before, black running backs. The story may have been apocryphal, but it was also true that Permian football benefited from desegregation. It was clear that the coaches expected black athletes to be better because of a belief that their bodies matured earlier than did those of whites. If a black didn't perform up to expectations, it usually had to do not with ability, but work habits. "There will never be a mediocre black athlete to play at Permian," said Hearn. Because of their skill, blacks were openly coveted in Odessa in the football arena. Some would never accept their presence on the team, but many others did, based on the ability to meet the following special conditions. Having a speed of 4.6 or better in the 40, great hands, and the perceived ability to cover twice as much ground from the middle linebacking position as could any white boy. The only way to lose that preferred standing, of course, was by not performing. "We don't have to deal with blacks here," said Lenita Akins. "We don't have to have any contact with them, except on the Permian football team. It's the only place in Odessa where people interact at all with blacks." As she sat in the stands, Akins watched with fascination how the fans accepted the presence of blacks on the Permian team, as if they were, for the time being, part of a different race altogether, as if something magical happened when those boys donned the black and white. "Those boys are not niggers to them," said Akins. "They are mojos." To Lawrence Hurd, there was nothing surprising in that attitude. He was well aware of the enormous allure of the black athlete and the doors that participation in sports supposedly opened, the barriers that it supposedly broke, the way whites suspended all racist judgments when they sat in the stands and gazed down at a football field or a basketball court or a baseball diamond. He also knew that many black kids thought their easiest way out of the ghetto, perhaps their only way, was through sports. After all, what universally accepted black role models did these kids really have besides the three J's, Michael Jordan and Bo Jackson and Magic Johnson? Where else in the world, particularly the white world, did they see blacks consistently gain such praise and prominence and acceptance? Considering the circumstances of their lives, how could they be expected to accept the harsh reality of studies showing that of the 30 million children taking part in youth sports in the United States, only about 200 would go on to become professionals in any given year? Lawrence Hurd had an opinion about sports. He firmly believed that football, like other sports, used blacks, exploited them, and then spit them out once their talents as running backs or linebackers or wide receivers had been fully exhausted. For a few lucky ones, that moment might not come until they were established in the pros. For others, it might come at the end of college. For most, it would all end in high school. And what would they have after pouring every hope and dream into sports? Hurd believed he knew the answer. A few memories and an education so inadequate they might have difficulty reading their names in big boxcar letters. Before, it was take the blacks and put them in the cotton field, let them do farm work, let them do share crops. In the 20th century, because of football, the real smart people use these blacks just like they would on the farm, and when it's over, they don't care about them. Some people say in their mind, that's all they were good for anyway. Today, instead of the cotton field, it's the sports arena. They were strong, provocative, important words, the very trademark of Lawrence Hurd, but no one was listening. He wasn't any longer a gifted, powerful minister leading a community in a struggle for social change. Instead, he was just another repeat offender in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere, behind rows of razor wire that glinted and gleamed in the sun like jagged teeth. Some considered his life a poignant tragedy, an impossible battle that he ultimately lost between the two souls that raged within him. The Lawrence Heard, capable of doing marvelous good for the community, and the Lawrence Heard, who had spent much of his life as a street hustler, after finding little appeal in being a pantry man for the rest of his life. "If only he could have kept that other boy down," sighed the Reverend Hansen. "I don't understand how you can do so much good for people, speak up for them, and care about them, and do so much harm to yourself." Others, not quite so benevolent, believed his actions had let down a community where the role of black leader was a precious, almost sacred commodity. Heard had had it all in Odessa: recognition, respect, dignity, clout. And then he let it go for reasons that were hard to fathom. "I guess that's the mystery. I guess that's the mystery that I've never been able to figure out myself," he said in the prison visiting room one day, his voice turned throaty with age, sounding like the bristles of a broom pushing against a slate floor. Sometimes when he talked, his eyes would close, and the fingers of his hands would splay across the table, as if they were trying to touch the very part of him that had caused his life to go so wrong just when it seemed to be going right. But then his eyes opened, eyes that were jaundiced and tired, and he spoke with a melancholy weariness. He was tired of giving explanations, tired of being held up to the light and examined, as if he were some rare specimen being taken out of an airtight jar. Lawrence Heard, the social activist. Lawrence Heard, the bank robber. Lawrence Heard, the eloquent spokesman for integration. Lawrence Heard, the master of three-card Monty. Lawrence Heard, the model of black success. Lawrence Heard, the model of black failure. There were others like him who had fallen off the path and given in to the old demons. He wasn't the only one. "I guess sometimes there's some force within me that takes great control of me. Who knows? I can't say. You ask me why there's been such drastic change? I wish I knew." Chapter 6. The Ambivalence of Ivory. Part 1. There were moments when Ivory Christian loved the game he tried so much to hate. You could tell by the very way he lined up at the middle linebacker position, up on the balls of his feet in a cocked crouch, fingers slicing slowly through the air as if trying to feel the very flow of the play, elbows tucked and ready to fire off the snap of the ball in a mercuric flash. He even liked it sometimes during the early morning workouts that were held twice a week before classes started inside the school gymnasium. The players ran at full strength under the angry glaze of the lights, the first-string offense and defense going against so-called scout teams, simulating the offense and defense of the coming week's opponent. No one was supposed to tackle, but every now and then Ivory pounced out of his crouch and drew a bead on some poor junior running back, unfortunate enough to have become the focal point of his frustration and the need to unleash it on someone. As the unsuspecting prey went around the end, still adjusting to the slightly surreal notion of practicing football indoors on a basketball court at 7:20 in the morning, Ivory just smacked him. There was the jarring pop of helmet against helmet, and then the trajectory of the underclassman as he went skittering across the gleaming gym floor like a billiard ball, hopping over a pool table after a wild cue shot. Ivory then sauntered back to the huddle, as if he were walking down the runway at the Miss America contest, basking in the glow of ultimate victory, but careful not to